Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Here's the question, where have all the grown-ups gone? It's going to be a fascinating discussion. We're going to have on the program today Diana West in the next segment. She's the author of the book, The Death of the Grown-Up. The subtitle is How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization. You wondered what was bringing down the civilization? It's Americans who won't grow up and won't be adults. Diana West will be our guest in just a few moments. First, to review some other issues in the news at my website at albertmohler.com, I posted a review of a very interesting book. It's by John Vincent, a professor of history at the University of Bristol in England. He also has been a fellow of Peterhouse at Cambridge University. He is an iconoclastic historian, which is to say he's a conservative historian in Great Britain. And there has been a response to his teaching. Sometimes his classes and things have even been the subject of protests. Why? Because he is resolutely against so much of the postmodern confusion in the field of history. Now, for instance, he argues that history is about evidence. He goes on and says it's also about other things, hunches, imagination, interpretation, guesswork. First and foremost, though, comes evidence. No evidence, no history. Now, here's the point he's trying to make. An awful lot of what passes for history in this postmodern age is the assumption that you can reconstruct the story without evidence. And the allegation is that what you have in history is the story of the powerful and the powerless, those who are without money, without power, without social leverage, their stories aren't told. Now, John Vincent comes back and says, well, it really can't be any other way. Because history is about evidence, and the people who leave evidence tend to be powerful, and they tend to be rich. They also tend to be male, and they tend to be older. Very interesting. He says this, and in terms of how history is done. He says history is incorrigibly male. He says it might not always be the case, but it's the case now. This also doesn't mean that women matter less than men. It might mean, he says, and I love this line, that women have better things to do than live their lives on paper. So if you're going back and you're looking at a particular historical epoch, you're likely to find the records of kings and princes and presidents and prime ministers. You're likely to find generals and military people. You're likely to find people involved in commerce and all the rest. They're the people that leave the diaries. They're the people that leave the books, the records, the correspondence, and all the rest. They're the people whose ideas become formulated in the laws. They're the people that are in the official records of the country. Now, I love the way he is able to put things so clearly. He says that history picks up where literature leaves off. He says, and that means with the relatively old. That's why he says history isn't necessarily about romance. That's for literature. It's about who actually gets married. You'll just have to leave all the rest of it to the imagination. Here's an excerpt from what he had to say, and I love his ability to write with such clarity. He says, history is deeply male. History is essentially non-young. History is about the rich and the famous, not the poor. History favors the articulate, not the silent. History is about winners, including those losers who were eventual winners, not about losers. History is about assessing distortions, not copying out truths. History has to live with, is indeed the child of, censorship. The censorship by one culture of its predecessor. The censorship by a great modern bureaucracy of its own overproduction of records. The censorship of astute reticence by those aware that the eye of posterity will watch them. History has much to say about the way the powerful handle power, for power engenders records. History is almost silent so far on psychology, but copious on sociology in the sense of social structure, less so perhaps on sociology as values. History is hopeless on love, but excellent on hatreds. Such a state of things may not please all, but then it never was meant to please. One-sidedness lies at the heart of historical knowledge. You know, that is just so profoundly right. What you have is one culture replaces another. The one culture eradicates a good deal of what it has replaced. And thus, what you find is the records of the new culture in its place. I love what he says here about history being hopeless on love, but excellent on hatreds. Why? Because history is filled with war and the records of war. Peace does not produce the same amount of historical material as does war. That's why military history is such a large part of the history section at your local bookstore. Just something to think about. It's a reminder to us that history, like every other academic discipline, is politicized and controversial in this day. It's good to know someone who is trying to think clearly about such matters. You'll find a reference to this book entitled The Intelligent Person's Guide to History at my website at albertmuller.com. Today in New Orleans, the Archbishop of Canterbury is in his second day of meeting with the bishops of the Episcopal Church USA. He is pleading with them, at least that's the expectation, to accept the demands, the directives, as they are called, of the Anglican primates within the worldwide Anglican Communion, that the American Church agree to cease and desist from further consecrations of openly gay bishops and from the blessing of same-sex unions. As the media are now reporting, no one expects the American Church to say yes to those demands. Let me read here from the report by Michelle Borstein and Jacqueline Salmon in the Washington Post. They write, "No one expects the mostly liberal Episcopal Church to fully give in, although thousands of Episcopalians have left the U.S. Church in recent years, including those in 19 Virginia congregations, to join more conservative branches of the communion based overseas. U.S. church leaders have generally dismissed them as a dissident minority. But four U.S. dioceses recently said they might try to leave if they don't like what happens in the meeting in New Orleans. At least a half dozen bishops sympathize with that position. These are mostly bishops who have echoed conservatives' concerns that Jesus' primacy is being watered down, but who think the global debate about how to read the Bible is an enduring one. The fence-sitting bishops have been the target of an intense lobbying campaign." Now, we better keep our minds and our eyes focused on the fact that this ultimately comes down to biblical authority. Like every other significant controversy in the church, it comes down to who has the say. And the question is, does Scripture have the say, or does some other kind of modern knowledge have the say? And that's really what's at stake here. You have people who say, we now know what the Apostle Paul couldn't have known, and that is that homosexuality is normal. And we're supposed to now go back and say that the Apostle Paul could not have known that, and we do now know it. And so we will relativize the biblical text. Now, there are all kinds of interpretive games that people try to play. But one of the interesting things about this Anglican and Episcopalian debate is that most of that is now past history. They've kind of gotten past the game-playing stage. When the Archbishop of Canterbury personally shows up in New Orleans to meet with the bishops of the American Episcopal Church, that's the Episcopal Church USA, it is no doubt an historic occasion, and the stakes could not be higher. In Beijing, there is a new Catholic bishop appointed with the apparent cooperation of the authorities there in Communist China. According to the Washington Post, the Reverend Joseph Leshan, a 42-year-old priest based in downtown Beijing, was ordained as the head of the Beijing Diocese of the state-sanctioned Catholic Church Friday morning in a private ceremony. What's going on here is that it looks like the Chinese government is doing its dead-level best to appear cooperative. They have been at an impasse in recent years, that is the Roman Catholic Church and the Chinese authorities. And there are also, of course, enduring conflicts between evangelicals, in particular the house churches, in China and government authorities. But with the Olympics coming up, China is very concerned about its public image. What this means for the Catholic Church in China, I guess only time will tell. But Time magazine is out with a major story indicating again that China is trying to defend its record on religion. The government saying that all Chinese can worship as they choose with no restrictions, even as the United States government continues to say that Beijing and the communist government persecute some believers. Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Yang Yu said a recent U.S. government report on religious freedom, quote, flagrantly interfered in China's internal affairs, end quote, and, quote, contained groundless accusations about China, ethnic and religious policies, end quote. It'll be very interesting to see, with the Olympics coming, how much really comes to light of the state of Christians in China. But there is very good reason to suspect that a fair amount of persecution continues, and the claim that Chinese can worship as they choose with no restrictions certainly seems to be a claim not substantiated by reports on the ground. Speaking of reports on the ground, here's an interesting one, and it's coming from Germany, where there is a politician there, Gabriel Pauli, who is running to become head of the Bavarian Conservative Christian Social Union Party, who is arguing that marriage there, civil marriage, ought to be for a term of 7 years. Her argument is that marriage isn't lasting anyway, so you might as well just put a term on it and let persons see at the end of 7 years if they actually want to continue to be married. Now, she is identified in this press, and this is from the Times of London, as Germany's most glamorous politician. She says many marriages survive only because people think it gives them security, but only love should count. In other words, she says, take the security away, we'll find out who actually loves each other. Now, that's about as backward an argument about marriage as I think you could probably ever conceive. In fact, it's so atrociously bad it's helpful, because it should remind us that we know what marriage is. An institution created by God for our good, the union of a man and a woman for a lifetime, an institution in which a husband and a wife, having made that command and that covenant together, obeying that command, are to find and make happiness and to find and to know true love. Back with a conversation with Diana West about why Americans won't grow up coast to coast. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Diana West writes a weekly column that appears in many newspapers, including the Washington Times. That column appears every Friday. She's written for the Wall Street Journal, the New Criterion, the Public Interest, the Weekly Standard, and you could go on. She is also a regular contributor to CNN's Lou Dobbs Tonight and Lou Dobbs This Week. She is, most particularly for our interest today, the author of a really interesting new book entitled The Death of the Grown-Up, the subtitle, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization. Diana West, welcome to the Albert Mueller Program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I have to tell you, I was anticipating your book. One of the major issues of my own writing and lecturing is about this delayed adulthood, this extension of adolescence.
Yes.
And you really do a good job of laying that out. How in the world did this happen?
Well, I think it's been a long time coming. And I think it's something that a lot of us recognize, but I have that same question. How did this get started? I think that a lot of it had to do with the period immediately following World War II, the 1950s, not the 1960s, as is commonly thought. We had a period of economic boom. We had a brand new youth market that was created in response to a lot of money in the pockets of children, actually preceding the baby boom, really. And you see a transfer of cultural authority going from adults to young people at that time. This was, of course, only emphasized once the baby boom started to come of age and go to college and so on with what we see, looking back to the 1960s. But I think we do have our roots that far back, and it's really important to kind of tease them out and try to understand them.
Well, one of the things that most concerns me about this history is that you have the development of this new species known as the adolescent, a term that until Stanley Hall really started using it wasn't even really known to Americans,
mm-hmm.
because the old distinction was between child and adult. Now there's this third creature, this adolescent, and then we start warehousing them in high schools.
Right, right. It's interesting you use that term because, of course, the great, large, enormous public high school is a relatively new feature of everyone, you know, of common life. I mean, in other periods, staying in school wasn't always even happening, but certainly these large high schools and junior high schools too brought kids into a world where they were dominated by other kids, and the adult influence suddenly was literally very small. And that's another factor in some of this this development. Again, there was also a new sense that adolescence was a period not just to sort of grow through, but really something to focus on and to treat as, you know, is kind of a be-all and end-all period of our existence. And I think when you talk about this third creature, the adolescent, I think it's where we're pushing our kids too soon, and it's where we're leaving ourselves long after we grow out of it. So it's almost like we're morphing into a great, large adolescent being.
And at least socially, psychologically, and spiritually speaking, a lot of people aren't growing out of it, at least
right.
until their 30s.
Well, hopefully, we hope that they finally emerge. It's kind of interesting. There have been some scientific studies where they are actually trying to name 34 as the end of adolescence, which is just kind of mind-boggling.
Well, it will mean the end of the race.
I'm sorry.
It will mean the end of the species eventually, because you know how far out can this go? And you have the delay of marriage, the delay of,
right.
of childbearing, and it has huge social impact.
Well, it really does. And there's also this sense of of questing for an identity, which can be very attractive in a very young person, but that, you know, continues on and on and on. And one thing I tried to explore in the book was how this actually had an impact beyond the family circle, beyond the very local kind of personal experience, because I think that this delayed sense of adulthood, this kind of pressure not to become mature, has also had repercussions in terms of who we are as a people. And, you know, we used to talk about, in the 80s and 90s, we talked about the so-called culture wars, which had to do with, you know, Western-dominated canon being replaced by a more multicultural canon in the schools and universities and so on. And that was all very well and theoretical, but, of course, after 9/11, I felt that these questions come back with a much greater urgency because, again, we're sort of facing these same issues. Who are we? What is a Western identity? What is liberty based on? Does jihadist Islam allow for coexistence? You know, and these are the kinds of things that I think are deeply related to our failures to grow up.
Well, one of the symbols of a failure to grow up is that we now have adults who may even be the parents of adolescents, who are dressing like adolescents. You actually
right.
mentioned this in your book. In fact, let me read to you back a few of your words. You said that these days, of course, father and son dress more or less alike, from message emblazoned T-shirts to chunky athletic shoes, both equally at ease in the baggy rumple of eternal summer camp.
Right.
That's pretty scary.
Well, it is. And you know, one of the things I looked back to was a wonderful novel by Booth Tarkington called 17. And people sometimes talk about it as the first novel about teenagers, really. It was written about 100 years ago. And the plot turned on the 17-year-old boy wanting to stand out from the other 17-year-old boys when a pretty young girl moves to town. And the way he does that was by kind of sneaking out with his father's tuxedo. So, in other words, he wanted to look like a grown-up. And you think of it now in terms of what a 17-year-old boy who wants to impress a girl wants to look like, and it's a completely different self-image. His father even has a tuxedo, of course.
Now, you talk about the unbearable lightness of being a grown-up today, a condition that belies the ever-thus canard that our social order is no different than the one our parents inherited.
Mm, yeah.
What are you talking about there?
Well, I think a lot of people will say this to me, and of course it's kind of a natural reaction. Haven't we always been this way? Hasn't always the most recent generation rebelled against the generation in control? And certainly that is a natural human impulse, but I think there's a huge difference between then and, say, post-1950, and that is that through this decline of adulthood that I try to trace in the book, we come to kind of a mainstreaming of the countercultural kind of pose, the eternal rebel, the anti-authority figure that we see, you know, we think of when we think of student radicals in the 60s or rock and roll kinds of, themes. And it has changed what used to be the very solid kind of middle class backbone of the country. I think that everyone is fairly bohemian at this point. I mean, in terms of dictating or not dictating, but just representing, reflecting a kind of standard of behavior. So in our time, we don't really have anything to rebel against. It's almost like everything has been done to a large extent, and you don't have that sort of reflex, moralistic backbone that once upon a time turned back, for example, a lot of the social upheavals of the 1920s. There was still what I call in the book the Babbittry, named after Sinclair Lewis's famous book Babbitt, which was about, you know, a spoof on the Rotary Club. That doesn't really exist anymore.
No. You know, this is such a live issue, not just in terms of social analysis, which you've done so well in this book. And I have to tell you, I think it's kind of two books in one. One about the very personal aspect of delayed adulthood, and the other about the impact in terms of the larger society. And as you say, the future of Western civilization. My guest today is Diana West. She's the author of the book, The Death of the Grown-Up. I'm going to hope she can stay with us for our next segment, and we can take some calls from you. You can join the discussion by calling 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Why is it that Americans evidently don't want to grow up? Just go to the shopping mall and look around. You'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Back with your calls. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. My guest today is Diana West, author of the book, The Death of the Grown-Up. I commend the book to you. I'm going to mention it at my website over the weekend at albertmohler.com. The argument is really important. You know, last week on this program, we were discussing why so many young adults aren't getting married. The data is absolutely incontrovertible. The data points come down to this. Right now, the likelihood that a young man in his 20s is married is less than 1 out of 4. And that's really, really something new in human experience, not just in terms of our national experience, but human experience. Diana West, in her article, her book, that is, entitled The Death of the Grown-Up, she mentions something called red light district parenting. And I want her to describe that. Diana West, we're so glad you're here on the program today. I want to come back to you. So many adults, indeed parents, seem to be acting like kids. What's going on there?
Well, do you want me to talk about the red light district parenting?
Because that's a part of, again, parents not parenting. They're not being adults.
They're not parenting, exactly. Well, it's interesting. There are statistics that show that there is actually not very much friction between parents and their teenagers anymore. We think back to the generation gap, of course, where there was tremendous friction. But it all makes sense that everyone gets along to a certain extent now because the parents are quite similar to their adolescent children. They dress the same way as we talked about earlier. They often listen to similar, if not exactly the same, kinds of music. And they have similar attitudes about life and entertainment. And it goes on and on. They're not laying down the law.
Well, specifically, you're talking about parents even facilitating things like drinking and sex.
Yes, this is what really got me mad when I actually started thinking about it in those terms. I have young kids, and they're not so young. They're 14-year-old twins at this point. But, you know, coming up through the schools, and of course, other anecdotes and studies I've looked into, but you know, you get so much propaganda from your schools about keeping your children safe, physically safe. And the way schools generally teach this in terms of, for example, drug use, the way we're supposed to keep kids safe from drugs is to teach them all the terrible things that could happen to them if they take them. And to do so, we tend to instruct them in every kind of fine point about street names for drugs, how to make them, how to cook them on your stove, all of these incredible just exposure to the worst of society in order to supposedly make the kids decide not to use them. This is also true in terms of sexual experimentation. We provide them with, quote, information so they can make choices. That's another wording, scare quotes. And yet there is no moral, religious basis that these kids are being given on which to make any kind of decision. You can keep a child innocent of all the terrible things out there and still have the child behave rationally and protectively if the child knows that, yes, virtue is its own reward and that there are moral and religious reasons not to behave badly, but schools in our society tend not to want to make these, quote, value judgments.
And so do a lot of parents not want to make those value judgments.
Yes, and so the phrase I came up with means red light district parenting actually means it tries to show how the parents try to contain, kind of like police try to sometimes contain lawlessness in a red light district. Parents similarly try to contain just basically criminal or almost criminal behaviors of their youngsters, underage drinking, drugs, and of course sex, by keeping them in a home or driving them, if they're inebriated, to another home or perhaps renting a hotel room for these things to go on. And it struck me as just the most kind, just ugly and non-parental kind of behavior. They really tend to enable their kids to do all kinds of things that they shouldn't, meanwhile hoping that they merely remain, quote, safe. And it just doesn't cut it. And you know, we all know horror stories that are related to this kind of thing. But I definitely go through quite a lot of them in a chapter called Parents Who Need Parents.
Well, that tells you a whole lot right there, that very phrase, parents who need parents. What America needs is grown-ups, and especially when you start looking at some of the pathologies and social patterns all around us, it looks like not only are adolescents extending their adolescence into adulthood, but America itself has adopted something of an adolescent posture, both within its own life and as it faces the larger world. Back to talk about that with author Diana West in just a moment. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back. The phenomenon of an extended adolescence is something that American society is accommodating itself to. You just look at what's happening in terms of even the fact that so many young adults are going back to live with mom and dad. That's at the personal level, the family level, maybe even the social level. But Diana West, in her new book, The Death of the Grown-Up, extends it to the nation, suggesting that America, as a civilization, isn't acting much like a grown-up on the world stage either. Now, Diana, what do you mean by that?
Well, what I end up doing in the book, and this was actually what really drove me to write the book, because it seemed so very urgent to me after 9/11, I try to take some of these same observable patterns of behavior and examine them and relate them to our failures, I think our failures, to rationally discuss and debate and analyze the struggle that the Western world finds itself in against what we can only describe as expansionist Islam. This is something that nobody wants to discuss. Our leaders, military and civilian, do not. We've, you know, seen the president go from, at the very beginning of the war, he talked about evildoers. He flirted with Islamo-fascists or something, and now he's back to just plain extremists. And I believe that this comes about from a kind of desire to live in a world of pretend, that our habitual political correctness has conditioned us to. And I really find it's not unique to any part of the political spectrum, which is part of the reason that I'll peg it to the death of the grown-up syndrome. It seems like we're all creatures of our time, left and right, and there's just a tremendous failure to come to grips with reality, which is something that you can certainly frame in terms of childishness. I mean, there are other ways to describe it, but it certainly does seem to fit.
Well, when you look at America on the world stage, you really point to Islam as what you see as the central challenge for this civilization in years ahead. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I do. I don't think it's the only threat, but I certainly see it as the most pressing threat, because it's not so much the threat of violence that I think challenges us in terms of our survival, as my book says. I think the whole notion of Islamization, which can be a peaceful process, which we see it quite advanced in Europe, in much of Western Europe, is actually a greater threat even than the threat of violence, which I think we can, not live with, but we can take measures against. And the reason we're so prey to Islamization goes back to this notion of openness that we prize above all. And it turns out it's kind of a brain teaser in a way, but you can't preserve tolerance if all you are is open. If you can't draw the line at intolerance, at some point your sense of tolerance is going to be overridden. And I think we do see that in this clash between Islam and the West.
Well, one of the things I appreciate about your book is that you are pretty clear about what Islam is about when it comes to the fact that every single faithful Muslim, regardless of whether he is a Shia or Sunni, regardless of whether they are now found in Indonesia or Kenya or in Iraq, they have to hope for the entire world to be brought under the Quranic rule of Sharia law.
Right.
And that's
right.
What it seems like a lot of Americans just won't be grown up enough to admit.
Well, that's the thing, and I would say that that was the big elephant in the room that no one wanted to discuss, for example, last week in the very heated hearings on Capitol Hill when General Petraeus came to call. We talk about, you know, the president still wants to press forward with democratizing Iraq, and yet there is no taking into consideration the profound challenge, or rather impossibility, of making this work out in any sort of Western-style model when you come up against the dictates of Sharia, as you mentioned, Islamic law, which, for example, under Islam, defines liberty. The word liberty in Arabic, in Islam, means perfect enslavement to Allah. So if we think of liberty more in terms of freedom of conscience of the individual, they think of liberty in terms of a perfect relationship with Allah. It's a very different, extremely different, in fact, completely antithetical notion. So we don't discuss that. We don't let that come into our policy papers. Our lawmakers seem completely ignorant, and our military seems afraid to say a word, at least at the highest levels. I think we're going to be seeing a very different kind of military evolve as some of these men, these mid-level and lower-level officers return from these fields of battle. I think they have very different attitudes, judging by my emails. But right now, I think that we're kind of strangling ourselves by not wanting to talk about things. And it isn't so much about wanting to change Islam, but it's just about a matter of wanting to understand what its impact is on a free society. And
what kind of challenge it represents.
Yeah, I'm sorry?
And what kind of challenge it represents.
It's a tremendous challenge, and you can't get anywhere if you won't at least discuss it. And that fear, I think, is something that I would call extremely childish, extremely immature, and very disappointing, because the stakes are so high at this point. It's not just a matter of, are we going to read Shakespeare or Toni Morrison, you know, in the local university. These are very important questions that do come out of culture wars, but in this case, it's a real culture war.
Now, let me tell you something. Just yesterday, I was on the campus of one of America's most prestigious universities, a long way from where I am right now in Louisville, Kentucky. And I won't name the university to make that point right now, but I'll just tell you, I spent quite a bit of time on the campus and in the bookstore, and there's very little there about the perpetuation of American civilization.
Mm-hmm.
But everything you could imagine about the study of every exotic civilization on Earth.
Right.
What does that tell you?
Well, that tells us that we don't really have a sense of who we are, what our identity is. And it's a complete outgrowth of the kind of leveling of authority that we can see coming out of the 50s and 60s. It wasn't just parental authority, it was cultural authority. So we have a situation where we are but one culture among all cultures, with the possible exception that, of course, Western culture is very often, you know, given the thought to be the worst culture. So it's no way to defend yourself if you don't know who you are.
Well said. We're very glad to have had as our guest today Diana West, who is the author of the book The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization. Go to my website at albertmuller.com over the weekend, and you'll find out more about the book and about the argument. Diana West, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
Folks, this whole idea of arrested development is something that we notice. We notice it in the schools. We notice it in churches. We notice it when you go to the shopping mall or just about anywhere. We're also noticing it on the world stage. I'll be back with some final thoughts about what all this means in just a moment. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. This idea of arrested development is really seen against an historical background. If you look back just a matter of a century or more ago, the average 20-year-old young man was either married or soon to be married and was engaged in a very responsible activity. It might have been higher education for an elite few, but for most it was work. They were men. Young men, yes, but they were men. This whole idea of adolescence, this indefinite period of time that begins, I guess, with puberty and then ends with something beyond, is now being extended 15, 17, 18 years. When you have sociologists and psychologists and others trying to suggest that the upper age limit for adolescence is 34, you have a huge problem. You know, this fact just absolutely captures my imagination. I've mentioned it several times on this program. The majority of young men aged in their 20s in Italy live with their mother. That's recognized in Italy as something that's never happened before. And in reality, here in the United States, this data coming just a couple weeks ago indicating that in 2006, almost 75% of young men in their 20s are never married, have never married at that point, and about 65% of young women. That's unprecedented in human history. And, of course, it leads to all kinds of other social pathologies as well. Dinah West, in her book, The Death of the Grown-Up, helps to focus on the fact that this is largely due to the society at large, but also to parents. I want to suggest it's also due to churches. You know, just as we as Christians look at this, we need to understand that as all of life is to be lived for the glory of God, there's a purpose in every season of life that God has for us to display His glory most clearly and most visibly in the world. And I want to suggest that means young Christians need to grow up, show what adulthood is all about, get about the tasks that God made us for, and show the world what it means to actually live out that kind of boldness. And this kind of arrested development is not a pretty picture, where you have adults that look like teenagers. And whereas in previous time, teenagers were supposed to be looking at adults to figure out how they were to grow up. This is a generation, to use Dinah West's language, of parents who need parents. Well, she extends this argument, of course, to the whole clash of civilizations and all the rest, suggesting that America is not only a nation of those involved in delayed adulthood, but absolutely is itself a case of arrested development. We do face big challenges, and just as young people face challenges that should require them to grow up to be adults, so does this country. It's worth this discussion. It ought to have particular relevance for people in the church who, again, know we have a higher calling than the future of America. And that's the glory of God in this world. And I hope parents are paying particular heed to this, realizing that someone's got to be a grown-up, and it's got to start with us. Back next week with you for Intelligent Christian Conversation, Coast to Coast. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.